Welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, April 1st, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled, Iowa Legislature Turns to Rest of Budget. After setting per pupil school aid, lawmakers focus on plans for taxes and other spending. It's written by Benjamin Fisher of the Telegraph Herald. Now that the Iowa legislature has set per-pupil school funding, lawmakers have begun working on taxation and spending plans to wrap up the 2024 legislative session. Area Iowa lawmakers in the Senate's and House of Representatives' Republican majorities recently told the Telegraph Herald the legislature was unable to truly begin tax and spending discussions until per-pupil student aid to school districts was set. We have to wait until we get a target number for the state budget, Iowa Representative Shannon Lundgren told the TH in Des Moines. The work kind of starts on the list of priorities that budget subcommittees would want to make sure we fund. We end up having a conversation about here's what the state revenue estimating conference said, here's what we can spend, here's the part that we keep aside because we don't spend 100% because the REC can be wrong. Public education spending is more than half of the state's budget. Because Republican Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and Iowa Senate leadership insisted on supplemental state aid being bound to their planned overhaul of the state's area education agencies and increases to minimum teacher pay, setting per pupil aid went several weeks past its deadline. Because of that and all of the new money, $380 million, that entailed the education spending side backed up Ways and Means, which backed any other appropriations talks, said Iowa Senator Kerry Colker, a Republican from Dyersville, an assistant Senate majority leader who serves on both the Senate Appropriations and Senate Ways and Means committees. So I would say the budget chairs, ways and means committees, and appropriations committees will be throttled down from here on out. We have Senate appropriations twice this week, and I have a budget subcommittee meeting on Monday. Republican lawmakers said before the session began that they intended to accelerate the phasing in of income tax cuts to a 3.9% flat rate that was passed during the 2022 session. While different related proposals have been floated this session, no solid plan has advanced yet. Colker said the consideration of that idea would begin soon, but with no certain completion. At the end of the day, with the last tax bills we did, Iowans are going to see income tax relief no matter what, she said. It's the tax credits and all the additional stuff we were trying to get done this year that we have to now figure out. If not an acceleration, we work on that in the interim for next year. Some tax work already has begun, even while the school aid worked its way through the legislature. The House Ways and Means Committee last week advanced a bill to establish a competitive fund for tax credits to be awarded to small businesses. Investors or fund managers would be able to award $9 million in tax credits annually to businesses outside of the state's 12 most populous counties that have 200 or fewer employees and submit project proposals to grow jobs. After years of work, a land bank proposal, long pushed by Iowa Senator Pam Yoakum, a Democrat from Dubuque, advanced from the Senate Ways and Means Committee last week. It would allow local governments and nonprofits to form agreements to acquire dilapidated property for redevelopment. It's a wonderful public-private partnership that will begin to address affordable housing in our state, Yoakum said in the committee meeting, where she serves as the ranking Democrat. Committee Chair Senator Dan Dawson, a Republican from Council Bluffs, said the bill would be another tool in the toolbox for local governments if passed. A county might have a redevelopment office, or a city might, he said. This allows that any of those entities or a nonprofit have a way to come together toward that goal. The House also recently passed a bill to allow Iowa breweries and distilleries to export or import goods with states that also allow for exportation to Iowa. People pass through Dyersville and stop at Textile Brewing Company and love something that Textile made but is not distributed nationally, Lundgren said at the Capitol. This allows Textile to ship directly to that person in another state as long as that state has a reciprocal with Iowa. They have to allow direct shipping back. Republicans in the House also released budget plans last week. House Republicans proposed an $8.955 billion budget for the coming fiscal year, $404.8 million more than the current fiscal year, with the biggest increases in health and human services and the justice system. House Democrats accused Republicans of leaving the public in the dark as to how the budget would be spent. Colker said Senate Republicans did not yet have set budget numbers, but that they again would intend to be conservative. Next is an article entitled, New Business Ideal for Creative Couple. Nasser and Patricia Shahrivar's Bed and Breakfast in Maquoketa combines hospitality with their numerous works of art. It's written by Nick Juice of the Telegraph Herald, and the dateline is Maquoketa. Through the various business undertakings of Nasser and Patricia Shahrivar, there has been a common denominator, art. For the lifelong creatives, their newest venture in Maquoketa is no different. The Art Manor Gallery and B&B combines the Shahrivar's experience operating a hospitality business with providing a place to display their art, for which they have received various accolades over the years. The Italianate Victorian brick home on Maquoketa's 2nd Street sits near downtown and offers 6 comfortable bedrooms decorated with the couple's creations. It's a perfect place to have a gallery, Nasser Shahrivar said. We love the house. It is a beautiful home. The Shahrivar's work has taken them to various places around eastern Iowa, all while continuing to produce their art and creative work, which includes portraits and landscapes by Patricia and abstracts and small-town panoramas by Nasser, including of Iowa towns such as Manchester, Gutenberg, Elkader, and Dyersville. Many of those pieces are on display in D'Art Manor, which means art manor in Italian. Before starting their recent adventure in Maquoketa, the Shahrivars renovated and then operated Old Brewery Bed and Breakfast in Gutenberg for nearly 20 years. After that, the couple purchased 3 downtown buildings in Central City and rehabilitated them and turned them into a gift shop and art gallery. Their movements are inspired by their art, which is partially why Maquoketa proved to be the next destination. We came to the Maquoketa art experience to a show, Patricia said. The town and people are wonderful and very welcoming and friendly. Everyone said we should move here. We wanted to be a part of the artist community here. There's never a dull moment. They have so much to offer in this community. When the home on 2nd Street went up for sale, they knew it was meant for them. All the rooms in the bed and breakfast have queen beds and are themed, Patricia said. One room on the main floor is dubbed the Traveling King's Room and has a whirlpool bathtub. Another room is the Arts Master Room and features a bay window. Yet another room follows a Cinderella theme. Guests are treated to a homemade breakfast menu that varies throughout stays and includes blueberry waffles, omelets, muffins, French toast, bacon, and other offerings. A grand opening is slated for 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Saturday, April the 6th. To book a room at the home located at 311 South 2nd Street in Maquoketa, call or text area code 319-551-8343 or email artandgiftcenter@hotmail.com. For more information about the Shahrivar's art, visit e-artpro.com. And our final story from the front page of the Telegraph Herald, under the Love That Lasts series, is entitled Dancing Through More Than 5 Decades of Wedded Bliss. Dennis and Carol Ann Willenborg of New Vienna met at a dance and enjoyed cutting a rug together for many years. It's written by Michelle London of the Telegraph Herald. Dennis Willenborg remembers how he first learned to dance. My mother, Mary, taught me, said Dennis, now 78 years old. Growing up on a farm in Petersburg, he would help his mother with the evening chores, milking the cows and feeding the hogs. We'd go to the barn to milk the cows and she would play music, he said. She just loved music, and she would teach me to dance. That's how I learned to polka. After attending Bayless Business College in Dubuque, Dennis worked as the bookkeeper for Brunken Implement Company in Dyersville. On the weekends, he and his buddies would make the rounds of the dances in the area. One of his favorite dance spots was the Dubuque County Fairgrounds. At one of those dances in September 1969, he met Carol Ann Vasky, now Wielenborg, who was working at Montgomery Ward and living in Dubuque with her widowed mother. She and a group of girlfriends also enjoyed attending local dances. "My sister danced with a friend of his, and they took us home after the dance," said Carol Ann, now age 79. Dennis, who was driving with Carol Ann in the front seat, admits he was a bit uncomfortable riding with a stranger in the passenger seat. "So I thought we should get to know each other," he said. "We just talked, and then we'd meet up again at dances. They soon became a couple, and it wasn't long before talk of them getting married began to circulate in their social group. Sitting in his car one evening, Dennis broached the subject with Carol Ann. He said, 'Everybody thinks we're going to get married. Do you think we should?' Carol Ann said. So that's how he popped the question." Dennis and Carol Ann got married just 7 months after they met on April 11th, 1970, at Church of the Nativity in Dubuque. "Oh, everybody talked about it," Carol Ann said. "They all thought I was pregnant. Dennis even had a neighbor that marked the date on the calendar to see if I was going to have a baby before 9 months was up." She would do that for all the couples she knew that got married. Their oldest daughter, Christine Rolfs, was born more than 9 months later, and they went on to have three more children after Christine: Ron, Andy, and Kathy Willem. They also have 9 grandchildren and 12 great-grandchildren. After a honeymoon in Nashville, Tennessee, where the highlight was a trip to the Grand Ole Opry, Dennis and Carol Ann moved to a farm his father had bought that bordered the family farm. Dennis started a new job as an accountant at Ertl Company in Dyersville. Carol Ann, who then was working in the office at Dubuque Packing Company, left her job to help on the farm. Dennis's mother Mary sold the cows on the farm before he and Carol Ann got married, knowing the added burden of working off the farm and coming home to farm chores would take time away from the newlywed couple. "She said she was not going to make her son work days and then come home and do all those chores at night," Carol Ann said. "She was the sweetest lady you ever knew." Once their children were born, Dennis and Carol Ann moved to a property with some acreage on the edge of New Vienna. It has been their home for 40 years. Christine of Piasta remembers the vegetable stand she and her siblings had each summer at the end of their driveway. "We sold carrots, beans, tomatoes, corns," she said, "and it was all fresh picked by us each morning. It was something we did every day during most of the summer." Christine said that work ethic came from her parents. "They just always worked hard," she said, "and they loved to polka. They'd go to dances all the time when they weren't working." While still at Ertl, Dennis partnered with Alpine Plant Food, a Canada-based fertilizer company, and launched Wielenborg Ag Service. Dennis left Ertl in 1997 after 24 years and went to Modern Fold in Dyersville, where he worked until 2011. He continued to run Wielenborg Ag until that time as well. Founded in 1974, the ag business now is run by their son Andy, though Dennis said he hasn't fully retired. "I help him out when he asks," he said. Carol Ann turned her hobby of painting custom cement lawn ornaments into a thriving business, Wielenborg Lawn Ornaments, which she sold in 2019 after more than 30 years of sending her creations all over the U.S. and to several other countries. "That started out as just a hobby in the basement," Christine said, "but Mom and Dad really supported each other. They'd say, 'You want to do something? I'll help you do it.' That's just how they always were." Christine has fond memories of accompanying her father on fertilizer deliveries and attributes those trips to her coffee drinking habit. "My brother and sister and I would take turns going with him," she said. "He wouldn't have anything in the truck to drink except coffee, so that's how that started." Until a few years ago, Dennis and Carol Ann enjoyed cutting a rug anywhere they could find a dance. Health issues have forced them to slow down a bit, but Carol Ann still gets together with a group of girlfriends who would spend their weekends at the local shindigs decades ago. "We still meet once a month in Dubuque," she said. "There are 8 of us, and we still like getting together when we can." Carol Ann leads tours at Heritage House Museum in New Vienna, and they both enjoy the occasional night out for pizza at their favorite restaurant, Joe's Pizza in Gutenberg. As members of St. Boniface Catholic Church in New Vienna, faith is an important aspect of their lives. Carol Ann said it was Dennis's gentle nature that first attracted her. "It was just a feeling," she said. "He was gentle. He wasn't a big loudmouth. He wasn't a boozer. He's so tender-hearted, and we just clicked. Dennis said he was pretty sure Carol Ann was the one for him right after that 3-mile ride home from the dance where they met. You can get to know a person pretty well in a few miles, he said, and I knew we had a friendship right away. We had common interests, and we for sure had dancing. That brings us to an article entitled Easter Hikes Calming and Restorative. This is written by Eric Hagstrom of the Telegraph Herald. The sounds of Easter celebration trilled, buzzed, chirped, and whistled. With continuing birdsong as a soundtrack, Jessica Schreier spread her feet, steadied her hands, and snapped a photo of bright green buds on an otherwise slate-gray plant. I've been trying to photograph things that are in renewal, things like plants popping up, said Schreier of Dubuque. All of the little buds that are coming up on certain plants and seeing that the squirrels and the birds are out and about and all the music that they are providing are definitely signs that spring is arriving, which is exciting. Schreier was among the people spending part of Easter enjoying the outdoors at Mines of Spain State Recreation Area near Dubuque. I think it's very calming and restorative, Schreier said of the time she spent among the trees, plants, animals, and birds. It makes me feel more relaxed and centered. Schreier paused on her late morning hike to crouch low to photograph a walnut's half shell, a black and brown nugget nestled next to a pair of bright green leaves emerging from a gray and beige mix of soil and plant debris. I'm also photographing things that are maybe saying goodbye as well, she said. Some of the things look like they're a little worse for the wear today. Along the paved trail nearby, Lola and Aubrey Shepherd of Monticello, Iowa, darted from one grassy patch to another, seeking specially painted eggs that had been placed along the trail in recognition of the holiday. I like seeing the places where they are hidden, said 11-year-old Lola as her 8-year-old sister Aubrey grinned while holding a light blue egg painted with the logo of Dubuque County Conservation. The Shepherd girls were visiting Mines of Spain for the first time Sunday. I really like it, Lola said. It's really nature-y. On her hike, Schreier crossed small bridges and descended stone steps as she stepped deeper into the forest below the E.B. Lyons Interpretive Center. The new season was on her mind. I have tried the last few years to be out more in the winter. My children have tried to teach me to appreciate all seasons, but I definitely do appreciate spring the most, she said. Hearing the birds singing together is so fun, hearing all of their different noises. I wasn't really thinking about how much bird song would be happening today. Next up, Chamber honors Cascade Customs with Business of the Year Award. Others receive various types of recognition. This is written by Jake Borges of the Cascade Pioneer. Cascade community and business leaders gathered inside Legion Hall recently for Cascade Area Chamber of Commerce annual dinner, where three businesses took home hardware honoring their work. Cascade Customs by JKP Designs won top honors as Business of the Year. The award goes to a business that prioritizes a high community impact, exhibits the highest standards in delivering goods or services to their customers, and promotes and provides a high quality of life for their employees. Among the comments from the nominations, the businesses' fundraising and community support were highlighted. Thank you very much, co-owner Kelly Petten said as she addressed the crowd. We do enjoy being a part of the community from afar. I'm so thankful for my family who is able to run our business here for us, and I'm thankful for all you guys. Many of you guys are customers, repeat customers, referring customers, and we appreciate everything. The business joins Annie's Treasures, Otting Body Shop, Riverbend Retirement Community, Cooper Financial Services, Happy Joe's, and Cascade Lanes, Onward Bank, Lions Service Center, Cascade Elementary School, Kerps' Service Center, and Acura Healthcare in earning the annual honor. The dinner also served as a platform for a pair of new awards. Mark Weber was honored with the Legacy Award, which honors a business or person with a long history of promoting business and community interests who is either taking a step back, nearing retirement, or leaving a position. Weber and his company, Weber Construction Incorporated, were selected for being generous with their resources, including assistance with Aquin Little Angels Early Childhood Center. Weber took a job with Klusener Construction, but will keep Weber Construction in operation and hold on to his smaller equipment for small jobs, he said. It wasn't easy doing what I did this past month. I just was ready to do something different, take on a different role. I hope it all works out, Weber said, emotion creeping into his voice. It will. It relieved a lot of stress from my life right now, but I want to thank everybody here. The Pioneer Award, handed out to a new business or a business expanding to offer a new service, went to Rise Counseling and Consulting, PLLC. This year's winner of the Pioneer Award has brought a very important and brand new service to Cascade, Chamber Board member Chantel Orr said while introducing the award winner. This organization gives to the community in a way that many people don't see, helping people cope with trauma and pain, stress, future worries, and other mental health worries. Other businesses nominated for awards include Bob and Lou's American Iowa Manufacturing Incorporated, Cascade Communications Company, Cascade Pioneer, Cheryl's Flower Garden Bakery and Coffee Bar, Luna Ray Spa and Wellness, and McDermott Oil Company. Here's a couple articles from under the News in Brief heading. First, hearing date set for public input on Wisconsin natural resource issues. Wisconsin residents will have opportunities to provide input on natural resource-related questions at in-person hearings held in every county. The hearings are held annually by the Wisconsin Conservation Congress and Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, according to a press release. All hearings will be held at 6 p.m. on Monday, April the 8th. Area locations include Grant County Youth and Ag Building, 916 Elm Street in Lancaster, Lafayette Community Multipurpose Building, 11974 Ames Road in Darlington. Residents may provide input online at dnr.wisconsin.gov/about/wcc/spring-hearing from noon April 10th to noon April 13th. Topics will include proposals to change the general open season for trout in inland streams, allow some deer parts to be left in the field after harvest, and extend the fall turkey season. And 7 nominated for Dyersville Woman of the Year event slated for April 17th. 7 women have been nominated to receive Dyersville's annual Woman of the Year Award. The recipient of the award will be announced at the Dyersville Area Chamber of Commerce's 27th Annual Women's Night event, held from 5:30 to 9 p.m. on April 17th at Dyersville Total Fitness, 1019 15th Avenue Southeast, according to an online announcement. This year's nominees are Cami Buffelli, a volunteer with the St. Francis Xavier School Association, Ashley Hall, who raises funds for pediatric cancer causes and supports families dealing with alopecia, Jamie Lammers, an organizer of local markets who runs Cottonwood Custom Tees, Krista K. McLean, who offers services such as microblading through Lasting Beauty by Krista, Vicki Recker, a contributor to Dyersville who has served as an art teacher at Western Dubuque High School, Emily Sneddon, president of the St. Francis Xavier School Association, Monica Steffen, a K-4 behavioral specialist at Dyersville Elementary School. The event also features a meal and entertainment. Tickets are available for $25 or $30 for early entry and can be purchased at the Chamber office, 1116th Avenue, Court Southeast. Now we'll turn to today's opinion page, and we've got another view entitled "A TikTok Ban in U.S. Would Give Musk More Election Sway." It's written by Kaven Schroff of Dream for America, and Kaven is the press secretary at the nonprofit and the senior advisor for the Institute for Education in Washington. This column was distributed by the Tribune News Service. As Congress revisits the notion of banning TikTok over security concerns and potential influence on the 2024 elections, it is crucial to widen our lens to include the equally concerning dynamics at X, formerly Twitter, under Elon Musk's ownership. Although a forced sale of X, given its U.S. ownership, is not on the table, Ignoring the platform's threats simply because of this difference is a grave oversight. I'm a political influencer on X and TikTok, and it is clear to me that should Americans lose access to TikTok, X's role in the digital discourse landscape would only expand. Musk's tenure at X has been marked by promotion of far-right ideologies, the monetization of disinformation and censorship. Musk has not only promoted figures associated with white supremacy and platforms aligned with Donald Trump, but has also banned journalists and enacted policies that stifle dissenting voices. Musk's actions, from promoting divisive content to selectively amplifying voices that align with his views, underscore a troubling trend toward platform manipulation. Though the means of Musk's interference might not be through X's algorithm, the impact of the 2024 election could be just as alarming as TikTok's predicted influence. Critics of the proposed TikTok ban, in actuality, the bill that passed the U.S. House would require a forced sale of the Chinese-owned app, have lauded the transparency of X's algorithm as a solution to concerns over platform manipulation. Consider business magnate Mark Cuban, who tweeted, "My view of hashtag TikTok ban, any social media platform that allows users under 18 must publicly publish their algorithms. There will be plenty of people who will publish how the algos work so parents can be smarter about what their kids are seeing, just as @X@Elon Musk currently does." However, Musk has made it clear simply publishing the algorithm to a social media platform does little to correct its biases. For example, Musk has demanded that the X algorithm over-amplify its own posts. Given that Musk's feed is essentially a cesspool of far-right conspiracy theories and disinformation about the national migrant crisis, forcing this content into users' feeds is essentially a massive in-kind donation to Trump's re-election campaign. Algorithm aside, X has also created a monetary incentive for viral disinformation through its new policy of paying verified users for engagement. Of course, Musk has destroyed Twitter's original verification system, now simply selling the infamous blue badges to those willing to pay, while some claim the platform's community notes system, which offers fact-checking and context on misleading posts, addresses some of these issues. Here again, Musk has weaponized the tool on behalf of far-right extremists. Musk, who has more than 170 million followers on the site, has had community note fact checks removed from his own posts, including a recent tweet falsely claiming that undocumented immigrants vote. Almost every illegal is a Dem voter. Beyond Musk's manual manipulations of his platform, he has also engaged in blatantly hypocritical censorship, despite insistence that he is a free speech absolutist. X has engaged in selective content deals that promote one-sided viewpoints. Tucker Carlson, a white nationalist and former Fox News host, has a show on the platform. In January, ex-CEO Linda Yassarino introduced a slate of other shows that would be launching, including ones hosted by Tulsi Gabbard and Don Lemon. Gabbard is reportedly a contender to be Trump's vice presidential pick, and Musk canceled Lemon's show after an interview he did not like. More alarmingly, Musk has taken to banning journalists and famous users who criticize him. TikTok has become a vital digital space for many political content creators and consumers, especially those who left Twitter following Musk's takeover. With Meta pulling back from political content on Instagram and Threads, X would surely regain its position as a primary source for online election news and discourse if TikTok is no longer in the picture. There's no doubt that lawmakers are right to worry about the harmful role TikTok could play in the 2024 election. However, scapegoating TikTok would not address the larger issue that our social media landscape is woefully unregulated and controlled by mercurial billionaires. If TikTok disappears in the near term, we must be realistic about the perhaps even more pernicious role Musk's X will play in this election. And again, this was written by Kaven Schroff, who is the press secretary at the nonprofit Dream for America and the senior advisor for the Institute for Education in Washington. Now, here's a reminder that you are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Today's second opinion piece is entitled Sad Story in Haiti Keeps Getting Worse Without Any Type of Happy Ending in Sight. It's written by Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune. In Haiti, history repeats itself repeatedly. And for what remains of Haiti's troubled government, history seems to keep getting worse. Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry and Kenyan President William Ruto signed an agreement in early March to fast-track a long-delayed deployment of Kenyan police officers to confront spiraling violence in the island nation. But a day later, the Kenyan government put the brakes on the deployment. The feckless Prime Minister Henry, long propped up by Washington, resigned overnight. Kenya would have to pause the deployment, they announced, and would reevaluate once a new Haitian government is in place. If only it were that easy. As tough as it might be to install a new Haitian government, it too often has been harder still to keep one in place. The news reminded me of my last trip to Haiti, with a group from the Committee to Protect Journalists, on whose board I was a member. I met in early 2004 with then-President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a charismatic priest from the slums who was first elected in 1990 with about two-thirds of the vote. Jubilant Haitians hoped in Aristide's first go-round in the 1990s that he would bring calm and prosperity to the poorest country in the hemisphere. Members of the country's military and other elites were not so sure. Their skepticism proved prescient. He lasted less than a year before he was pushed out by a coup. Haiti lurched between military and elected governments for the rest of the 1990s. Finally, Aristide, still popular with the poor, was re-elected in 2000, this time bringing a tougher attitude and a troubling new reliance on criminal gangs. But that peace proved fleeting, too. In late February 2004, gangs loyal to Aristide went on a rampage and unleashed chaos in the streets of the capital of Port-au-Prince. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell's pledge of support for a proposed international peace plan was roundly rejected. Aristide finally lost his nerve, avoiding a bloodbath by arranging with American officials to flee the country. Peace was restored with the helpful arrival of about 2,000 U.S. Marines. An interim government was established in a process run by Haitians. James Foley, U.S. Ambassador to Haiti in 2003 to 2005, recently recounted in a piece published by the Washington Post. Today, almost half of Haiti's population is struggling to find food, clean living conditions, and a sense of hope amid yet another period of chaos. The Biden administration, already struggling with other foreign and domestic crises in Gaza, Ukraine, and this country's southern border, shows little appetite to become deeply immersed in perennially troubled Haiti. Yet our attempts to inch away from Haiti breaks with a Caribbean relationship that dates back to the late 19th century. Our worst move, Foley argues, was this country's decision during the Trump administration to withdraw all UN military and police personnel from Haiti between 2017 and 2019. Removing a credible Haitian security force led to the progressive collapse of state institutions and opened the door to the recent anarchy in the streets. That's a fair point, but it's no secret that many Americans have grown wary of trying to solve too many of the world's problems when there's little guarantee that we won't make things worse. Looking back on my own admittedly modest experience on the island, I was most impressed by the many Haitian business leaders and nonprofit heads with whom I met. Haiti has many talented and resourceful people in those sectors. The Haitian diaspora, whose remittances to family members back home account for about a fifth of the nation's gross domestic product, provide a resource of knowledge, leadership, and productivity that can help the troubled island break its cycles of poverty and hopelessness if given more of a chance. Again, this was written by Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune. In health news, why are black people more likely to develop glaucoma? Scientists discovered new clues in the largest study of its kind. It's written by Tom Avril of the Philadelphia Inquirer. A team led by University of Pennsylvania scientists has discovered three genetic variants that offer the first strong clues as to why glaucoma disproportionately affects black people. The variants are common in people with African ancestry and are associated with a significantly higher risk of developing the sight-robbing disease, the researchers found in their study of more than 11,000 volunteers, including 6,300 from the Philadelphia area. More research is needed to determine if these variants, each consisting of just a single letter among the 3 billion parts of letters that spell out the human genome, play a direct role in causing glaucoma. But if they stand up to scrutiny, the findings someday could be used to develop better treatments and identify people who could benefit from them, said Shefali Satya Verma, one of the lead study authors and an assistant professor at Penn's Perelman School of Medicine. The idea is that this can help identify individuals who are at higher risk before any symptoms occur, she said. Previous studies have found more than 170 other genetic variants that are involved in glaucoma, a condition in which the optic nerve becomes damaged, often as a result of increased pressure inside the eye. But most of those studies were conducted among white or Asian populations, despite the fact that glaucoma is more common in black people and, when it occurs, is more likely to lead to blindness. And most of the genetic variants discovered in those previous studies turned out to play little or no role in the disease for black people, illustrating the need for diversity in study populations, said Penn physician-scientist Joan M. O'Brien. It was a hugely unmet need, she said. That's what prompted O'Brien, Verma, and their colleagues to launch the new study, which is among the first and by far the largest conducted among black people. O'Brien blamed the shortage of studies partly on the justifiable misgivings that many black people hold about medical research, citing examples of misconduct such as the Tuskegee experiment in which black men were not treated for syphilis. Ongoing bias in medicine continues to contribute to mistrust. For instance, black patients are less likely than white patients to receive pain medication and less likely to be admitted to a hospital from the emergency room. Until recently, they had to wait longer than white patients for a kidney transplant. Clearly, there are reasons for individuals of African ancestry to distrust studies and distrust medicine and distrust many things related to science, she said. That does not excuse us from trying to involve people of African ancestry. So she and her co-authors then embarked on an unusual campaign to enroll volunteers, spreading the word as they conducted vision screenings at predominantly black churches, community centers, and health fairs. Edie Miller Ellis, a Penn ophthalmologist and study author who is black, also promoted the study on black-owned radio station WURD. They ended up with 11,275 study participants, including the 6,300 that Penn physicians enrolled from the Philadelphia area. The rest came from elsewhere in the United States, as well as Ghana and Nigeria, recruited by collaborators at other institutions. The scientists started by comparing the genomes of study participants who had glaucoma with the genomes of participants who did not, identifying dozens of genetic variants that differed between the two groups. Then winnowed down that list to the final three by conducting a series of laboratory studies in human cells. They also validated their findings by checking them against other genetic databases, including Penn Medicine's own biobank, a repository of blood and genetic samples of which 17% were contributed by black people. All three variants were found in non-coding regions of the genome, what used to be erroneously referred to as junk DNA, or stretches of DNA that lie outside the genes. But as scientists have found in many other instances, these three variants, despite not being part of any gene, appear to play a role in the activity of nearby genes. One of the variants was associated with a 75% increase in the risk of glaucoma. The other two each were linked to a 25% increase in the risk of the disease. The three variants appear to play some sort of causal role in the disease, but more work is needed to be sure what that is. O'Brien, director of the Penn Center for Genetics of Complex Disease, hopes that someday the findings could be incorporated into a rapid test suitable for use in a primary care office. Such a test would allow physicians to identify and counsel at-risk patients before they are aware of any symptoms. People with the disease often are unaware they have it, as it typically starts with declining peripheral vision, which patients might not notice at first. The genetic findings also could guide the development of better drugs, O'Brien said. Currently, physicians treat the disease by trying to lower the pressure inside the patient's eyes, first with medication and later, if needed, surgery. But those tactics don't work for everyone in whom the disease is caused by elevated eye pressure, O'Brien said. And in some cases, the disease can occur in people whose eye pressure is normal. We know it's not just the pressure, she said, but that's the only treatment we have to give. Now it's time to turn to the sports page, and we'll start with what's on the air today. In MLB baseball, you can see the Texas Rangers versus the Tampa Bay Rays at 5:30 p.m. on FS1. And in women's college basketball, it's LSU versus Iowa, 6:15 p.m. on ESPN. And then UConn versus USC at 8:15 on ESPN. The top story is entitled, Fighting Saints on Brink of Winning Conference Title. Beating Team USA, U18's a huge confidence boost for Dubuque. It's written by Jim Leitner. Fisher Scott routinely leads the Dubuque Fighting Saints in block shots on a nightly basis. On Saturday night, he brought his teammates to their feet with his stick instead of his skin pads. The second-year defenseman scored 139 into overtime to give the Saints a wild 7-6 victory over U.S. Hockey's National Team Development Program U18 squad at the I'm On Arena. Neither team led by more than a goal in a seesaw affair dominated by Team USA's James Hoggins, who scored four goals and assisted on a fifth. It was a crazy game. 7-6 is definitely not the type of game we're looking for, but we're glad we came out on top, Scott said after scoring his eighth goal of the season and second overtime winner. It was exciting. The barn was jumping and everyone was pretty pumped to win this one. To get 3 out of 4 points against them this weekend is pretty big for our confidence. They're one of the top teams in the league. They compete against and beat college teams, so it's exciting for our group to beat them. It shows we can skate with and beat anybody. The Saints improved to 38 wins, 12 losses, 3-4 for 83 points, and clinched a first-round playoff bye by securing standings points in a 7th straight game. Dubuque reduced its magic number to just 1 to clinch the first Eastern Conference title since 2012-2013 and has 5 games remaining in the regular season. It was ugly, but we found a way, Saints coach Kirk McDonald said. We gave them 3 or 4 goals. With all the talent they have, we didn't make them earn all of their goals, but I liked the way we kept responding. Now we're off for the first round of the playoffs. Next step is clinching the conference. We just keep checking off boxes. On the winning goal, Eric Paulson won a battle along the right wing wall in his own zone and sprung Beckett Hendrickson for a line rush. Hendrickson carried it into the USA zone and centered a pass for Scott, who beat goalie Nick Kempf to his blocker side. The teams combined for 4 goals in the first period and 8 more in the second, before Kempf and Dubuque's Dylan Johnson turned the third into a goaltender battle. Johnson finished with 31 saves, including 15 in the third period and none in overtime, while Kempf made 30 stops, just 6 between the third period and overtime. My job is to give the team a chance to win the game, Johnson said. The result is all that matters, whether it's 1-0 or 7-6. We got the job done. It was a super offensive weekend, but in the third period, we just tried to bear down because we knew we had a chance to win the weekend. Hendrickson opened the scoring on a line rush at 10:49 of the first period. His centering pass met resistance at the net front, but he tapped it past Kempf for his 22nd of the season. Juraj Pekarich and Paulson assisted. Teddy Stiga tied the game at 3 minutes and 37 seconds later, but Matthew Desidero regained the Dubuque lead at 15:29. Hendrickson, Paulson, and Juna Vasanen worked the puck around the perimeter before Desiderio snapped his second goal of the season into the top right corner of the net from the left circle. Hoggins' first goal of the night leveled the score at 16:32. Noah Powell scored his league-leading 39th goal to extend his Saints single-season record at 3 minutes 49 seconds of the second period. Vasanen and Scott moved the puck along the blue line before Powell ripped a slap shot from the top of the left circle through traffic and past Kempf. Hoggins tied it just 15 seconds later and completed his hat trick at 8:54 to give the Team USA a 4-3 lead, but Colin Frank needed just 26 seconds to tie it again. He drove the net and tucked a Nick Romero pass into the net for his 9th of the season. Michael Barron picked up a secondary assist. Hoggins potted a short-handed goal at 10:41 to put Team USA back ahead 5-4, but Powell forced a turnover 1 minute 6 seconds later, and Gavin Cornforth fed Hendrickson for a backhander that went under Kempf's arm for a second goal of the night. Team USA regained the lead again at 16:05 on a Will Skon shot through traffic, but Lucas St. Louis struck on the power play 2 minutes and 31 seconds later to make it 6-6. He scored on a backdoor tap-in set up by James Reeder and Pekarik. His 15th career power play goal tied Max Montes and John Gaudreau for the franchise record. No matter the circumstances, we'll find a way like we did tonight, said Hendrickson, who finished with 2 goals and 2 assists against his former team. That comes from the belief we have in the locker room. We know we have a good team, and we're one of the best teams in the league for a reason. Our next article is entitled, Driving the Game, Clark Reese, a Major Part of the Rise of Women's College Basketball. It's written by Doug Feinberg of the Associated Press. The dateline is Albany, New York. Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese have been catalysts for the rapid rise of women's college basketball because of their play on the court that has drawn millions of new fans to the sport and their success off of it. The pair has brought comparisons to what Magic Johnson and Larry Bird did for men's college basketball when they played for the national championship in 1979 and then in the NBA for the decade after. While Clark and Reese weren't born yet when the two NBA stars were playing, they appreciate the comparisons. I would say me and Angel have always been great competitors. Obviously, she played in the Big Ten for a while to begin her career, and that's what makes women's basketball so fun, is you have great competition, and that's what we've had all year long, Clark said of Reese, who transferred to LSU from Maryland. They will meet in the NCAA tournament for the second time in 2 seasons when Iowa faces LSU in the Albany 2 regional final on Monday night. Last season's national championship game drew a record 9.9 million viewers. I think definitely those two players have had something to do with it, Iowa coach Lisa Bluder said. Reese said she and Clark are fine off the court and noted both are fierce competitors on it. A lot was made out of Reese trash-talking Clark after the title game. Clark was fine with it, saying then it was just part of the game. I think people just take it like we hate each other. Me and Caitlin Clark don't hate each other, Reese said. I want everybody to understand that. It's just a super competitive game. Regardless of who wins the rematch, both star players know they've left a lasting impact off the court. Just being able to have people say that she changed my life, she gave me inspiration, she gave me confidence, and I think I've done that in so many different ways, Reese said. Being a great player is amazing, but being able to have little girls or even grown women come up to me just like, thank you for being who you are, thank you for speaking out on things that I'm too scared to speak out on or I don't have the platform to use, just being able to have that person. Clark knows she inspired countless young girls and boys to fall in love with women's basketball. It's super special to see your impact not only in the state of Iowa but across the country, she said. To be able to have that impact on the next generation is really special, and you just hope to dream and aspire to be like you one day and chase after all their dreams. They also have paved the way for women's players to make huge money through their name, image, and likeness. The two have some of the highest valuations in the nation. Clark is just over $3 million, while Reese is at $1.8 million, according to On3.com. In a somewhat related article, Trash Talking, All Part of Women's Basketball. It's written by Pat Eaton Robb of the Associated Press. It was a signature moment of last year's national championship game. With victory assured, LSU's Angel Reese pointed to her ring finger and flashed the "You Can't See Me" gesture, waving her hand in front of her own face, at Iowa's Caitlin Clark, who had made a similar gesture earlier in the tournament. The move sparked a discussion over trash talk in the women's game, which is being renewed as the two stars prepare to face off again Monday in the Albany 2 regional final. "I don't think people realize it's not personal," Reese said. "Once we get out from between those lines, if I see you walking down the street, it's like, 'Hey girl, what's up? Let's hang out.' I think people just take it like we hate each other. Me and Caitlin Clark don't hate each other. I want everybody to understand that. It's just a super competitive game." Clark agrees that the trash talk is just part of the game. "When she does it," she said, "it's to fire up herself and her teammates, not to put down any opponents or get inside their heads. Both of us want to win more than anything, and that's how it should be when you're a competitor and you get into a situation like this, whether it was the national championship, whether it's the Elite Eight," she said. But Reese's coach, Kim Mulkey, questions whether the reaction to the players jawing and gesturing goes beyond a simple misunderstanding of competitive fire and into sexism, noting how no one seems concerned with trash talk in the men's game. "I don't choose to focus on that because you see it all the time if you turn on and watch pro games," she said. "I was a trash talker. I mean, thank God I didn't have all y'all following me, cameras and everything else. You're out there. You're trying to get after it." LSU's guard Haley Van Lathe said she doesn't expect people outside the game to understand that, especially those who've never played at this level. "Besides," she said, "trash talk is entertaining. It's a part of why people want to watch the game," she said. "I think when you think about hockey and the fights, people like to see that. That's not why we do it. It's our personalities. It's what makes the game fun for us." In Major League Baseball news, Cubs pick up first win. Ian Happ tied his career high with four hits and drew a tie-breaking bases-loaded walk from Jose Leclerc in a four-run ninth inning, helping the Chicago Cubs beat the Texas Rangers 9-5 on Sunday to salvage the finale of their opening three-game series in Arlington, Texas. With the score tied 4-4, Leclerc walked Michael Busch with one out, allowed Nico Horner's swinging bunt single down the third baseline, and walked Mike Tauchman. Miles Mastroboni grounded into a force out at the plate. Happ walked on a full-count fastball that sailed wide, and Seiya Suzuki greeted Jacob Latz with a two-run single. Cody Bellinger singled in the final run. Hector Neris pitched a one-hit eighth. Christopher Morel hit a three-run homer in the first off John Gray, who allowed five runs, four earned, seven hits, and three walks in 3 2/3 innings. In other news from around Major League Baseball, the Dodgers defeated the Cardinals 5-4. The Phillies defeated the Braves 5-4. Cincinnati defeated the Washington Nationals 6-5. The Pirates defeated the Marlins 9-7 in 10 innings. Arizona Diamondbacks 5, Colorado Rockies 1, Padres 13, Giants 4. In the American League, Angels defeated the Orioles 4-1. The Blue Jays defeated the Rays 9-2. Kansas City Royals defeated the Minnesota Twins by a score of 11-0. New York Yankees topped the Houston Astros 4-3. Detroit Tigers 3, Chicago White Sox 2, Red Sox 5, Mariners 1. And the Oakland Athletics defeated the Cleveland Guardians 4-3. In men's college basketball, Boilermakers end Final Four drought. By the time all the scrapping and scratching and diving on the floor was over, it felt like a shame that both teams and both those players weren't moving on to the Final Four. Just don't expect Purdue to feel bad about it. Boilermakers big man Zach Edey went for a career-high 40 points Sunday in Detroit to muscle Purdue within 2 wins of the title for the first time since 1980 with a 72-66 victory over Dalton Knecht and his never-say-quit Tennessee teammates. The 7'4" Edey, a unanimous AP All-American, didn't even need a ladder to cut down the net after edging out Knecht, another All-American who finished with 37 points. The game's top two players and their teams went back and forth all day. How close was it? There were 6 ties and 8 lead changes. With 5 minutes left and the score knotted at 58, both players had scored 31 points on 12 field goals. According to Opta Stats, this was the first time opposing players scored more than half their squad's points in an NCAA tournament game. Edey missed 8 of his 22 attempts from the foul line. One of those misses sparked the play of the game. After Tennessee grabbed the rebound and worked the ball down court, Edey swatted away Knecht's layup as he drove to the basket while trailing by 5 with 33 seconds left. It was Edey's only block of the day, and it put an end to the Vols' desperate comeback hopes. Top-seeded Purdue set aside last year's grand disappointment, a first-round loss as a number 1 seed, to book the trip to Glendale, Arizona. On Saturday, Edey and the Boilermakers will face big man DJ Burns Jr. and 11th-seeded North Carolina State in the national semifinals. "We had to take it," Painter said of the abuse that came last year. "Sometimes when you sit in it and you're honest with yourself and you take it, some great things can happen." Tennessee, a number 2 seed, was seeking its first Final Four, and Vols coach Rick Barnes was denied the second trip of his 38-year career to college basketball's promised land. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.